Welcome back to Trickle Down Socialism, where we discuss how the U.S. currently has a system of socialism for the super rich and corporations, where we try to defang the term socialism and explore how government, with just a slight tweak in priorities and a focus on social investment, could be a force for good in all of our lives.
Dan, what's going on?
Greetings. How's everybody doing?
Just doing pretty well. C-Money, how you doing over there?
Doing excellent. Yourself?
How's Portland treating you these days?
Weather's been pretty nice lately, but getting out for a lot of runs. It's been cool.
Got any lobsters?
I actually don't like lobster. I don't eat any seafood.
Turns out they're the bugs of the ocean.
I mean, that's how I've always thought of them.
If people love lobster, why would they smother it in so much butter? That's all. So yeah, we've got Rachel Rollins, the district attorney for Suffolk County, on this episode. We finally got the chance to interview her, and she's got a lot of great ideas on how to make our criminal justice system less racist. Definitely stick around for that, folks. But there's been a lot going on in terms of criminal justice and seeking justice for George Floyd. We've been watching the Chauvin trial, C-Money.
Yeah. I watched a little bit of it today, just kind of the closing arguments for the defense. And I thought it was interesting. There was a moment where the judge had the jury exit. And, apparently some new information came to light for the prosecution that would definitively show that George Floyd did not ridiculously die from carbon monoxide poisoning, as the prosecution has suggested, because of where he was positioned by the car. And the judge admonished the prosecution and said that he would call a mistrial if they introduced any of that evidence, which seemed a little heavy-handed, but I'm not super well-versed in trial law. But, you know, outside of that, the prosecution lawyer pretty artfully got to say it anyway.
Wow.
I thought it was some good courtroom drama, but it was also, it's sad that it's come down to like a question of if he died of carbon monoxide poisoning, when we've all seen that video like so many times.
Yeah, with the knee on the neck for 9 minutes. That couldn't have been what ultimately killed him. So Dan, you were struck by what the police chief said?
Well, my understanding is that in previous cases, police chiefs have not testified, or if they have, they've been decidedly sort of like code of silence about how they testified. And I was reading an article, and this is a quote from the police chief in Minneapolis. And he said, to continue to apply the level of force to a person pinned down, handcuffed behind their back, that in no way, shape, or form is anything that is by policy, and it is not part of our training, and is certainly not a part of our ethics or our value. To me, that is a direct rebuke to the police code of silence. And I think that's where we need to head, because you can pass all the laws you want at the local, state, or federal level, but if good cops protect bad cops, then it makes it so much harder to prosecute.
Well, and I have a little bit of a bone to pick with him on, in terms of their ethics and values. When you had one potential juror who was an Army veteran, a member of the Black community there in Minneapolis, who shared his own life experience of being in his neighborhood just after a Black man had been shot and killed. And the police were driving around the neighborhood with the windows down, blasting Queens, Another One Bites the Dust. So if you want to talk about ethics and values, it sounds like if that doesn't match their ethics, it might be more recent. And the, you know, the defense did strike that juror from the pool, but the juror did say that that was not an isolated incident either. And that just really, that sickened me to hear him sharing that detail.
What also troubles me about this is that my understanding is that Minneapolis is one of the more progressive cities in terms of implementing police reforms. In other words, there are a series of policies that have been in place to minimize police violence. But at the same time, Derek Chauvin had, 16 to 20 infraction?
Yeah.
You know, this is not a, quote, first-time offender, which is ironic, right? Because if you're Black and you're a first-time offender, you probably go to jail for 5 years. If you're a cop and you're first-time, second, fifth, tenth-time offender, you're cool.
Right, and D.A. Rollins is going to mention this in the interview, but She's put together a task force that includes five people that are not members of the police to review use of force and discharge of a weapon. And I think that's what you have to do, right? Like, Dan, you're mentioning the fact that you've got this code of silence and this, you know, the thin blue line and protecting your own. And that wall's going to stand up as long as we let it stand up. So we need people from outside of the police units to look into these, you know, horrendous abuses of power and use of force, especially when it comes to use of force against an unarmed black man in this case, or a member of any minority group.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Like you mentioned, Dan mentions the cracks in the blue wall of silence, you know, with the chief finally testifying and not really being able to remember any time in recent memory where a chief has testified against his own officer. You know, in the show notes, we also mentioned police Bill of Rights being repealed in Maryland, which relatedly is kind of a huge part of this. This seems like a tectonic shift in policing. Like it's interesting to see, I think, after all the protests last summer and kind of, you know, the Chauvin trial happening now, the Dante Wright stuff happening like 10 miles from the Chauvin trial. Like if it wasn't so sad, it would be almost poetic of an example of how systematic this is of an issue. And that you can't treat it with like individual trials for every bad person. Like it's a systemic issue.
Right. And that police bill of rights had come up in a conversation a few episodes ago with Mayor Bird, who said, you know, I asked him how he was doing in terms of police reform in his city of Greenbelt, Maryland. And he said, you know, they've done stuff on the local level, but they can't get past this police bill of rights. And so I was kind of taken aback when I heard that they were able to successfully repeal it. And it actually took a veto override.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, there's a state attorney that's in Baltimore. Marilyn Mosby, you know, related to the stuff you were talking about with D.A. Rollins, like she's also taken a stance since coronavirus of not prosecuting low level crimes as well, like dismissing all of that stuff. And just a couple weeks ago decided to make it permanent. It's no longer like a COVID thing because the impact has been a lot like what D.A. Rollins has seen, that they've actually seen these people not go back and commit crimes again, like a reduction of recidivism.
That's awesome.
By dismissing it. So I think it's cool seeing it, you know, Rollins in Massachusetts implementing this and Mosby in Maryland going for this. And then there are a bunch of other states that have also had these COVID reductions in prosecutions that they're making permanent. It's kind of neat seeing it go across the country like that.
See, Money, are you saying that threats and punishment don't motivate people?
Something like that. I know it's controversial, isn't it?
So there are a few things that I think we need to explain to any listeners who aren't from Boston. First of all, Dan, can you tell our listeners what D.A. Rollins might be referring to when she talks about methadone mile?
Yeah, so Boston is a really small city, even though it has a lot of history. But there is a place in Boston, sort of just off of the highway next to a major hospital named Boston Medical, and they call it Methadone Mile because there is a lot of drug use, a lot of panhandling, and from what I understand, a lot of human trafficking. And it's sort of an open-air drug. I don't know what the right word is.
She compared it to Hamsterdam on The Wire.
Right, yeah. It's just kind of like an open-air drug market because of the fact that a number of people are getting treatment there and the fact that there is a sizable homeless population there. So she'll also talk about neighborhoods, and I'll have you, Dan, explain one difference that she mentions. But first, we also need to mention that Boston politics have for years been kind of like the old boys club in the South. It's been run by, in this case, Irish Catholic politicians. Her predecessor was Dan Conley. The former mayor is Marty Walsh. But could you explain to the listeners, Dan, the difference between, she talks about how she chose to live in Roxbury, right? What's the difference between Roxbury and West Roxbury? What are the differences there?
Yeah, so Roxbury is a predominantly black neighborhood. And so she's chosen to live in a predominantly black and somewhat low-income neighborhood, though it is gentrifying. West Roxbury was never a part of the city. It was adopted into the city in somewhere in the 1800s, and it is bougie as fuck, and it's very white.
Right. So let's check it out. She's got a lot of really interesting things to say.
Mm-hmm.
Our guest on this episode is District Attorney Rachel Rollins. Rollins is the first black woman to hold the job as Suffolk DA. She came to office with a thoughtful and creative reform agenda that included reduced prosecution for minor crimes and an openness to vacating wrongful convictions. She's also called for more police accountability and transparency about police misconduct, which makes her unpopular in some law enforcement circles. She's generally accessible to the media and willing to explain her criminal justice philosophy. She has now been in office for 2 years, and her policies are starting to be supported by academic studies, which show that diversion works for society and for nonviolent offenders. Welcome to Trickle Down Socialism. We're honored to have you on the podcast.
I'm excited to be here.
It's so exciting. Could you briefly explain your approach to not pursuing relatively minor nonviolent infractions of the law? Why do you feel like that's a good approach?
So when I decided to run for office, I wanted to not just be someone that was complaining about a system that I saw not working for too many people. I wanted to try to propose a solution. And whether it was the right solution or not, we would ultimately find out. But I refused to just be somebody who complained. And what I chose to do, Patrick, was meet with every single group that comes into contact with the criminal legal system. Police officers, judges, criminal defense lawyers, probation, clerks, the community, right? People who are defendants, people who are currently serving time behind the wall. You name it, I sat down and asked their opinion. And to the person, nearly all of them, when I asked, look, if you had a magic wand and could change the system to be better, what would you do? Almost to the person, they said, we are criminalizing behavior that shouldn't be criminalized. So for example, mental health issues, substance use disorders, food and housing insecurity, and homelessness. Yes, some of the effects of those things are deeply troubling, and we see those every day, for example, in places like Mass Ave and Malnia Cass. But ultimately, those individuals, they're in crisis, they're in harm, and it's a public health crisis where we need other people aside from law enforcement at the table making decisions. So that's a long way of saying I came up with 15 types of crimes that all are nonviolent or non-serious, in my opinion. And I said, look, let's flip the presumption from arrest and incarceration or prosecution to declination, diversion, and dismissal. And it is a rebuttable presumption. So we can always go back to putting them in jail, right, which we are very good at doing. But let's turn it over on its head and see if we can get partners, community partners, you know, public health partners to assist us in this process. And then about 2 weeks after taking office, I said yes to some PhDs who said we want access to all of your data, because the most important thing is when we try something, we have to measure it and then be able to adapt if it's working or not.
And so that study was released, the NBER study, and it looks like it supports your approach. How does that feel to have that recognized by the academics?
So, yes, it was very nice to have the research and data support what we were proposing. And ultimately, there were three PhDs from, you know, NYU, Rutgers University, and Texas A&M that all conducted the research, which was published in the National Bureau of Economic Research. And basically, looking back over about 17 years, back to 2004, over 67,000 cases, they looked at all of my list of 15, which of course didn't exist back then, but they had the type of crimes, and said, look, when we dismiss this after a person comes into contact with the criminal legal system the first time, do they recidivate at a higher rate, for example? Do they come back into contact with the system doing the same or even worse, something else? And, you know, I am happy to say that when we decline or dismiss, they did not recidivate within those 2 to 3 years. When we actually arraigned them and moved them forward in the system, unfortunately, they recidivated at a much higher rate. So that, in normal words, right, for people, those of us that like don't, you know, put data nerd hats on all the time, which is okay. What it means is According to the data, when we turn people away and get them the help and services and treatment they need that is not carceral, they often don't come back into contact with the system. But unfortunately, when we bring this into them into the system, they touch the system again at that level or an even higher one. The most important part of that, though, Patrick, there's a few really interesting things. People love mischaracterizing my list of 15 as like, I never will prosecute them. That's not true. It is a presumption that is rebuttable. So if it's Patrick Donahue that comes into contact with the system for one of these 15 areas of crimes, and you've never done anything like this before in your life, or let's even say in the last 3 years, or there's a, you know, you're in a mental health crisis or something happened, it'll likely be declined, dismissed, or diverted pre-arraignment. If it's Rachel Rollins, and this is the third time I've done this in the last year in Suffolk County, and I've done it three other times in Middlesex County and once in Norfolk. All of those tactics haven't worked with Rachel Rollins. So we are going to move forward with an arraignment, and we are going to work hand in hand with the court, the judge in probation, to find an appropriate solution for Rachel, which might result in a carceral sentence or might result in some other program that the court and probation now have with the DA, the ability to mandate that you do. So what was interesting about the data is it showed in 56% of the cases, Rachel Rollins declines or dismisses or diverts. But Dan Conley before me did it in 42% of the cases. So a lot of people think it went from zero to 57 under Rollins. It didn't. My predecessor was doing this. He didn't trust you with that information, though. I don't want to sneak this by you. I want you to be aware of what we're doing. So that's number one. Number two, if I'm doing it in 57% of the times, that means that in 43% of the times, we're not doing it, if my math is correct, right? So that proves or disproves what the critics often say is she's refusing to prosecute. Well, no. In 43% of the times, we do move forward with those type of cases and we go to arraignment. Now, whether it's dismissed after that is a different story, but the brand of a criminal record happens after you stand at your arraignment.
Right. And so there are a couple of things I'm wondering there. One is the, you mentioned your predecessor, and I had read that, you know, that he was doing this, but had not really codified it. And it was more of a random approach, although it sounds like it wasn't too far off from the number of times you're doing it, right? What was the effect of that more randomized and also just not public approach of your predecessor?
Well, what would happen generally, like most things that aren't publicized, is it's arbitrary who gets to reap the benefit of it, right? So part of what I wanted to do, Patrick, and this is the beauty of being old, right? So I ran for office at the ripe age of 47 years old. I just turned 50 on March 3rd. And so when I ran, I didn't want to trick anyone into voting for me. There were five Democrats in my race. And about 6 weeks before the primary, the Democratic primary, I put up on my website in writing the 15 categories of crimes that in the first instance, I was going to decline, dismiss, or divert. And I wanted people to be able to look at that in writing and know that this is who I was going to be when I won. Not if I won, but when. And so when I won... And then won my general, and we are happy to say with over 80%, which to me means a mandate, right? When I implemented this after I was inaugurated on January 2nd, 2019, I was shocked that people were surprised because I'm saying like, guys, I'm being exactly who I told you I would be. Now, if the shock was based on, oh my God, she's a politician that told us who she was going to be and is now being that person, I stand in your shock, right? Because that is rare. But what the shock really was what is she doing? I can't believe she's doing this. And, you know, I reject the fact that you refuse to do your due diligence, right? Like I told you who I was going to be. I am being that exact same person. Stop acting surprised. So I think when you don't codify things, when you don't put them in writing, which was all of the reason why I did the Rollins memo, on March 26, 2019, 66 pages laying out my sort of vision board for what I believe this criminal legal system can be and the Suffolk County DA's office could aspire to be. I now have given the criminal defense bar, the community, and my staff, in whatever order you choose to put that in, a roadmap of what it is that we were trying to accomplish so that nobody could feel like they were being blindsided, right? So in addition to that, Patrick, we then did tons of training because, like legislation, if there's no language in there about enforcement or, you know, who is going to fund the funding source, it's not worth the paper it's printed on. Same things with policies. Like, I can't hand them something and say, go read the 66 pages and figure it out for yourself. We had to do significant amount of trainings and policies, practices, right, where we showed everyone what we were going to do. And we want to look at the data. We don't only want, you know, the white community to benefit from this. And quite frankly, we don't only want the Black community to benefit from this. We want to make sure this is an even-handed, you know, AAPI community, LGBTQIA+, Latinx, gender, you know, age. Is it only happening in East Boston Division of the Boston Municipal Court and not in West Roxbury? Is it only happening in Chelsea District Court and not in the Roxbury Division of BMC? How are we culling through our data to make sure that all of these opportunities are meeting people where they are? And the last thing I'll say is it takes out the randomness of, if you unfortunately come into contact with the criminal legal system and you have the good fortune of getting Assistant District Attorney Patrick Donahue as your ADA, and Patrick is culturally competent and thoughtful and can look at you and say, you know what, this is a kid that made a stupid mistake. He needs a little bit of guidance, right? And we're going to make sure he does some stuff, but we're not going to brand him with a criminal record. You reap the benefit of that random draw of this ADA, as opposed to somebody else who gets, you know, rack 'em up Rollins, right? Who just everyone goes to arraignment and we ask for the highest possible amount of time. It takes out that sort of arbitrary piece of it. So I'm excited about that.
You also mentioned your critics and some of the surprise when you took office. How have they changed their tone at this point now that it's been codified? We're seeing results, or are there still people who are claiming that, you know, petty criminals are going to have a heyday? I think I heard at the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's always hilarious, like the sort of font 108 when they're doubting you on the cover of the Globe. And then when the National Bureau of Economic Research sort of validates you, it's on page, you know, 319 back cover and your name's misspelled, right? So it's like, gee, thanks, media. But essentially, look, the critics are going to be the critics. And part of what they're saying is absolutely right. Like, nobody wants to hear, but crime is down overall 3% if there was just a homicide on your street, right? Nobody wants to hear, but the DA's policies are working. When at 6:30 in the morning, I was out at Mass Ave and Melnia Cast 2 weeks ago, and I, you know, it's basically like Hamsterdam in The Wire, right? It's an open drug trafficking market. It is a 1 mile radius of harm and hurt and crisis, right? Human trafficking, violence, drug trafficking and distribution. I'm not talking about possession. You know, and, you know, I push back often and say, look, we have all the cons of a public consumption site, a drug consumption site, and none of the pros, right? We have with the ODs, we have the deaths, we have the violence, and, you know, we also have all the trash. We have all of the, you know, sort of negative waste that we're seeing there. But we don't have any of the positive parts of that, where you don't see overdoses any longer. You see people getting the treatment and help that they deserve. And then we are really, I will say out loud that I am working very, very hard with BPD to make sure that we are having more targeted arrests and prosecutions in that area for the people that are preying on individuals looking to get the help they desperately need.
So do you support a public consumption site with nurses and, you know, the way they do it in other countries where it is decriminalized and people are watched as they're using?
Yeah. So I will say, and I think I'm going to go a step further than I ever have. In the past, maybe about a year and a half ago, because there was some litigation in Philadelphia recently where an Article 3 judge, so a U.S. District Court judge in Philly, found that a safe consumption site was not It's called the crack house statute. That's the colloquial term on the federal side. It's the Controlled Substances Act makes it clear that only the government or hospitals, right, with the blessing of the government, can distribute drugs, right? And so there's a piece there where the, you know, safe consumption sites, they don't hand you the drugs. You come in with that. They hand you the clean needle, the cotton, the alcohol swab, the, you know, all of the different stuff. And they have the medical staff to make sure you are not harming yourself. At first, I had said, look, I support anything where the answer isn't just, we're not going to do anything, right? If the answer is between, we're going to keep doing what we're doing right now, which is nothing, or we're going to leave the door open for opportunity, I'm always going to be open for more opportunity. I know there are cons to safe consumption sites, for sure. I've spoken to people from Canada who have dealt with that themselves, people in law enforcement there. I've actually gone to Portugal and seen some of these safe consumption sites that are, that, you know, are in operation there. But I will say we have to do something, Patrick, because this is bigger than you can even imagine. And people are dying at rates that we couldn't even comprehend.
Why do you feel that police accountability and transparency especially are so important?
So any government agency requires transparency. You know, our tax dollars pay for our government. We have the right to know what our tax dollars are paying for. I think the police are, though, several levels under a microscope, right? Many different sort of cliques that we should be looking even closer to police, because they're the only branch of our government that has the legal and the lethal authority to kill you with no oversight. They don't have to stop and make a phone call first. They don't have to get approval from a supervisor. They make a split second decision that you cannot appeal, right? Nobody comes back from those circumstances, right? Dante Wright, never coming back, right? We saw that second lieutenant that was pepper sprayed. He's going to live through that experience with some trauma, but luckily he's still alive and can sue or get whatever recourse he feels is necessary as a result of that unfortunate encounter. So I think with accountability, you know, for too long, they've been able to regulate themselves, right? And although there is an internal affairs division and an anti-corruption division in most police departments, they are police officers themselves. They have no outside reporting requirements, or if they did, they haven't been meeting them, right? And they have essentially been permitted to operate in a cloak of darkness and like unaccountability. And there is no other industry, not a single one that you can think of where that is even remotely considered appropriate, right? Could you imagine if I was a doctor and I removed one of your eyes when you had come in for like a toe surgery, and then you had to file a complaint with me and I got to go in another room and then come back and say, I looked over this. I didn't do anything wrong. Thank you so much. And then had to escort you out because you were missing an eye. Like, it's just crazy. So right now, I will also add, in the world of cell phones, Patrick, we've changed, right? Because what is happening is the world is conflating Ferguson with Boston. They're conflating Minnesota with, you know, Albany, New York. They don't see any difference between Derek Chauvin and Detective Rollins, right, who might be at B2 in Roxbury. And I've never had an issue in my life. I'm culturally competent. I've lived in these neighborhoods. I treat people with dignity and respect. I'm excellent at my job. We can watch these videos. We are vicariously traumatized watching them. And we think law enforcement writ large now is the problem. What we need to be better at is the narrative. And I think the police have not done a good job at the narrative. And part of it's their fault, but part of it is the media, because I like to point out that the Black and Brown community suffers from the same problem with the media that many white police officers do. We only ever see police officers that look like you, Patrick. We don't see them playing with my kids at a park. We don't see them pulling over and helping a grandmother. This is the stuff they do 30 times a day, right? We only see them when they're shooting an unarmed Black person, right? And the flip side of that is we only frequently see Black and brown men or women or communities when there's harm. So I'll give you an example. I'm the only person in my office that is obligated to live in Suffolk County by statute. The only person that has to live here is the DA. And I made a conscious decision to live in Roxbury as opposed to West Roxbury, where I have family and it's a beautiful place. But Roxbury, Dorchester, and Mattapan are the three places where, unfortunately, whenever you see my face on TV for a homicide, I'm usually there. And what's interesting is, you know, I wanted to make sure that I put myself in a place where I was able to have a lived experience and have skin in the game regarding the outcomes, right? The positive outcomes of what was going to happen here. And then also be able to, my hope is, uplift law enforcement when they're doing those great things and have it be my voice, not only holding them accountable, but also being loud when I say they did it right this time and we're really proud and they're leading the nation and these are the best practices when they do this type of thing. But, you know, it is really tough when they are silent rather than saying in a very short statement, for example, we denounce what happened and what Derek Chauvin did. We don't stand by that behavior. We stand with our community. Right. It is an incredibly hard job, but this sort of silence is now considered assent by many people in communities when we just keep living through what unfortunately feels like the Hotel California. Right. You can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave. Right. So it's this loop of we keep seeing the same thing. It's just insert a different name. And you know, we have to really work hard to have better relationships with law enforcement in our communities.
Sure. And to that end, you've recently created the Law Enforcement Automatic Discovery Database, I believe. Could you just explain to our listeners what the goal of this database is?
Sure. It's called LEAD, Law Enforcement Automatic Discovery Database. And it's basically a Brady list. And for the non-lawyers, that is not Tom Brady. That is Brady, right? It's an obligation as prosecutors for us to turn over exculpatory information. But a lot of progressive prosecutors, and quite frankly, even some conservative ones, go a step further. Like I've always been taught, look, I don't want to beat you where you don't have 50% of the information that I do, and I am hiding things from you to get the win. I want this to be fair, and it's not win or lose. Like I'm trying to get accountability for a family, you know, in a homicide, for example, who's had their loved one murdered, right? Like, so I don't want this overturned on appeal. I don't want something to go wrong where that family then has to live through additional trauma of having to retry this case. I want to turn over everything. So when there are members of law enforcement that engage in misconduct or criminal behavior or conduct unbecoming, we need to know about that as prosecutors, number one, and we need to make sure that the defense knows about it, right? So hypothetically, Patrick, if there was a police officer, and if you've read the newspaper, you know, who is now charged with 5 counts or more, 5 different victims of child rape that was handling child rape cases, right? Or we find out later alone with children after law enforcement knew that. Those are things that are questionable, right? Like if you know, it is information that the defendant in that case certainly would have wanted to know, right? Or, you know, if the member of law enforcement is found guilty of fraud or committing perjury or doing something that calls into question their credibility or their veracity or truthfulness, those are all really important things. Because remember, Patrick, when police officers walk into court, it's usually in their uniform, cloaked in credibility. Right. And I, as the DA or the assistant district attorneys, even though we might not call them expert witnesses all the time, we are essentially telling the jury, come on, look at this guy, Detective Donahue. He did this. He did that. He's perfect. He looks spiffy. How many times have you done this? 50 times. Great. Now tell us what happened here. you are cloaked in credibility. And if we are hiding information, or even worse, the prosecutor doesn't know about the bad things you've done because the police in internal affairs or anti-corruption haven't turned it over to us, that's a problem. So that's what LEAD is about, is just rooting out the problems. And look, all of them don't necessarily mean that the officer is going to get terminated or can't testify. It just means sometimes we need to get them some counseling or some training, right, to make sure that it doesn't happen again, or we need an explanation. But what I'm proud of, Patrick, is I meet with management of the police and I meet with union leadership of the police unions. And none of this was a surprise to them. We met with them. We gave them the samples of what we were going to do before we rolled it out. We heard some of their serious concerns. We adapted in some circumstances. You know, of course, if some of their concerns were like, please don't do this, yeah, that's not going to be my answer, right? But many of them, I know that seems flippant, but many of them recognize, look, of course, we got to make sure if we have police officers that aren't listening, I'd love to get rid of them if I could, or terminate them or discipline them. The union's going to defend them, but we need to make sure we're explaining that process to the community.
So now that cannabis is legalized in Massachusetts, should we be looking at making that retroactive? Should we be releasing prisoners who are still locked up because of marijuana convictions?
Absolutely. I mean, when we've seen Massachusetts not only has medicinal, but also recreational marijuana, it is now a billion with a B dollar industry. The very communities that have suffered the most harm as a result of the criminalization of cannabis are, you know, we were very proud that the statute enabling the sort of Cannabis Control Commission and the ability for people to profit off of cannabis had some really good language in there about impacted communities and impacted individuals. But unfortunately, like most things, we've seen that, you know, Black and brown and poor communities are not the ones reaping the cream of the crop, right, of this industry. So we have a lot more work to do. And it is insulting that it is now a billion-dollar industry, but there are people that still have the brand of a conviction for cannabis of some sort, or even, you know, hypothetically, would be serving a term still as a result of either a predicate offense that got them more time with some other new crime as a result of cannabis. So we have to do the hard work of looking back at that. And I am 100% supportive of that.
I would like to hear from you in terms of how much progress you feel like you've made over the last 2 years. Are there examples that you haven't mentioned yet that have really worked out well?
Oh, yes. So first of all, I do have to give props to DA Conley, because I inherited an amazing staff, right? We have over 300 employees that are just really some of the brightest, not just lawyers, but paralegals, administrative assistants, HR, IT specialists, victim witness advocates, investigators, and so on and so forth. So about half of my staff are lawyers and the other half aren't. And let me tell you something, as a lawyer, we couldn't do our job at all without the other half of the staff that do the really important work every day. So I created the first in the nation discharge integrity team. So a lot of this stuff that we're seeing when I talk to you about, unfortunately, Dante Wright, right, where earlier today it was just announced that the officer that mistook her her service weapon for a taser. And also Mr. Wright was pulled over because one of the air fresheners appeared to be blocking his mirror, which, you know, screams pretext, right? Or you know, some fake reason to pull this person over. Had that happened in Suffolk County, and I'm very happy it didn't, my discharge integrity team would be investigating that. Because what's really important to understand, Patrick, is police and prosecutors in 95% of the cases, we walk in hand in hand to court every day. They are my key witnesses for a lot of the crimes that we are prosecuting. We flip that on its head when there's an officer-involved shooting or an allegation of excessive force, or a police officer commits a crime, right? Because now it's the very prosecutors that they're used to being aligned with that are now investigating them and potentially prosecuting them. So rather than have that line blurred, what I did was create a team of four people outside of my office, a retired judge, a criminal defense attorney, a member of the community, and a sitting active member of law enforcement. And I'm the fifth member. We don't even meet in my office. And the case is presented to us. We direct and control the entire investigation. And then we make a determination. And I issue that decision. So my hope, it's the only one in the country, the way that this is happening, even among progressive prosecutors, that it gives the community some, you know, I hope, solace in the fact that there is separation between my office and these ADAs who have known these police officers for decades in some circumstance. I don't know any of them. I'm new to this job, right? So there's no bias that I have toward them with the finger on the scale of finding that it's reasonable and justified and we aren't going to press charges. So that's number one, discharge integrity team, very proud of. And then we created another first in the nation. A lot of these DAs, even conservative ones, they all will tell you we have conviction integrity. Now, the conservative ones, they don't usually do anything in their conviction integrity unit, or they say that's my appeals unit, and those are very different things. But we don't just look at conviction. We have the Integrity Review Bureau, which is convictions, meaning actual innocence, but also unethical, unconstitutional, or unjust or immoral convictions. So we have somebody who, for example, was convicted after the witnesses were hypnotized. I'm not joking. This is real, right? So thank God DA Conley undid the conviction of one of them. And I just undid the conviction of his co-defendant, James Watson. Okay. We have sentencing integrity where, Patrick, if you and I enter into a joint venture, you were the one that pulled the trigger. You know, I pointed the person out to you and drove you there. You walked in and pulled the trigger and left. I didn't kill, but I'm certainly culpable, right? I was involved. Under a joint venture, we can both be held responsible for first degree murder. We had a case where you and I both fled the jurisdiction. They found me immediately. And a jury convicted me, even though I didn't shoot them, of first degree murder without the possibility of parole. A year later, Patrick, they find you. You take the stand and admit, yes, I shot that person, and Rachel didn't and was not culpable. But let me tell you why. And your jury, which was different than mine, believes your story. You're found guilty of second degree murder, and you are released on parole the first time you're up for parole. So because in second degree murder, you get parole eligibility. And you've been home for 12 years as the murderer, the person who actually pulled the trigger and killed the individual. And I'm never going to see the light of day again. That does not make you don't have to have gone to law school to recognize that that's not fair, right? That's sentencing integrity. That's the Pedro Valentin case that we're fighting right now. We have case integrity to make sure that in real time, whenever something happens in a case, I don't want to wait, Patrick, for 30 years to find out we made a mistake. That's what all of our conviction integrity and sentencing integrity cases are. Right now, if the grand jury no-bills, if a judge grants a motion to dismiss, a motion to suppress, if a judge says, Suffolk County DA, you are being racist when you're impaneling your jury and striking people based on race or gender or some other protected category. If there's a mistrial, if there is a directed verdict, meaning the judge says, hey, Commonwealth, you didn't even meet your burden before you rested. You just rested. You didn't meet your burden. I'm dismissing this case. I learn about that in real time. I don't want to wait 20 years to find out something went wrong, because I want to make sure that we get training for those people and we understand what happened and we explain it to the victims. You know, and then also just for efficiency reasons, why are we wasting our grand jury's time if we can't even meet the very low burden of probable cause, not beyond a reasonable doubt. I'm just talking about probable cause to get a true bill in a grand jury. That person needs some training. And then the last of the fourth pillars of integrity review is the lead database. So really proud of that work. We just did the Hinton Lab initiative where we are doing the hard work of going in and saying, oh my God, this lab, Patrick, if you haven't watched on Netflix, the drug lab scandal, you know, documentaries they did, we are trying to vacate what happened out of that lab because it was just so poorly run. It had two terrible chemists and it had no management or oversight. They weren't following scientific protocols. I mean, it was just really a shameful chapter in our history. What we can't do is just say, oops, sorry. We have to undo that harm, right? And that's when people start believing in the system again.
Sure. And I really do appreciate that. I felt like that was a very bold choice to go in and try to vacate those. But I feel like, how can you have someone sitting behind bars knowing that that was going on at the drug lab? I'd like to close on this because I was so struck in prepping for this interview. I read this quote in a Globe article from February 18th. And I'm a feminist father of four young girls. And so I kind of want to ask your opinion of this after reading this quote. So you said, "We're attempting to change a system that has traditionally rejected our input and devalued or ignored our stories. I stand with my sisters in justice from St. Louis to Baltimore, Cook County to Portsmouth to take on a system that adversely impacts people who look like us and is nearly void of any Black women in leadership positions." So what I'm wondering is, how can we all play a role in taking on this system in order to win the struggle with white supremacy and misogyny?
I mean, I love it. So your daughters are so lucky to have you. You know, and I am a proud daughter of a girl dad who has two boys, three girls, but you know, everything I am, I have a wonderful mom too, of course, but is because of the love and support of my father who taught me that I could do and be anything that I put my mind to and never changed the rules for me because I was a girl. He wanted me to put my shoulders back and stand firmly in who I was and be proud of every part of myself. So how do we do it is we can't We are so far beyond a point, Patrick, where we can be silent any longer. We can stand on the sidelines. You don't have to be me, you know, and believe me, I wasn't even me a couple years ago, right? Like I was happy doing my little job and, you know, keeping my head down. And then there was just a day where I said, I just can't anymore. I instead of yelling at my television alone in my house, right, I am going to stop complaining and I'm going to sit up and I'm going to run for office. And we need those great criminal defense attorneys, those activists. We need the ACLU. We need conservatives. We need all of the people that are giving their input to the system, but some of them are outside the system. I wanted to go in and sit on the throne and tinker from behind the wall, right? And so that doesn't mean I don't want activists and adjutants and conservatives and, you know, Republicans and Democrats and blah, 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 blah. But I just said, I'm tired of complaining and not offering a solution or at least trying. And I may fail. You know, I want you to hear me say, had the National Bureau of Economic Research come out and said, you know, by declining these cases, those people come back and jump three levels into the most violent, serious crime. I would have called a meeting the next day and said to law enforcement, I'm sorry, number one. And number two, we are now suspending all, like, we would have adapted that way. I promise you that. It's easy to say it when you say like, haha, but it didn't, sort of. But I promise you, we were looking at the data and I wasn't able to edit anything these PhDs did. You know, but I will tell you, I just think we need allies and whatever you are passionate about, you know, there's no hierarchy on hurt, right? If you're interested in environmental racism or, you know, environmental issues, generally the Green New Deal, right? If you are looking at disparities in healthcare or housing, right? Or economic development and opportunities, as opposed to criminal justice issues, even though they all intersect, you don't have to be me, just like I don't have to be you. But what you can no longer do, in my mind, is sit by silently or wait until it impacts your community. Because, you know, for me, that's cowardice. And, you know, right now, I'm not trying to offend anyone, but it's just my people are dying in the streets, right? And we are beyond any measure of restraint. Like I can no longer tolerate that. So you can be that person that's going to do nothing, but you aren't going to get the benefit of me because I'm moving forward as fast as we can toward change.
Well, thank you so much, DA Rawlins. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. And I wish you luck as you continue to try to tinker with the system.
I love it. And let's stay in touch. I'm excited to hear about your girls. Be well, Patrick.
Take care. So, Dan, what did you think of what D.A. Rollins had to say?
You know, first and foremost, someone who is such a reformer. I mean, fundamentally changing the idea of the war on drugs to something of a...
diversion, getting treatment.
Diversion, yeah. Addiction isn't destiny, right? And it doesn't criminalize stuff that's not criminal. That's so cool to me.
See, Money, what did you think of what she had to say?
You know, my immediate impression of her was she was like super well composed and focused, super forward. I just really liked the way she talked about stuff in a really honest and forthright manner. I was really impressed with how she tied together a lot of different approaches people have talked about separately in the past year about police reform and criminal justice reform. You know, kind of like Dan's talking about, like, not criminalizing affects of mental illness like addiction. I mean, that's a huge thing. But tying that together with clean use sites, which, you know, is public health for people who need it the most, and then it gets them a lot closer to addiction resources and rehab instead of kind of criminalizing coping behaviors. I think that was super cool, and that she was talking about tying in either scrubbing records or sealing records for that, which I think is an essential part of that. That's kind of a conversation we've had going on up in Maine for a little bit and have a law for it now. So just seeing that she's thinking of like a holistic approach for like police and criminal justice reform that actually has like actionable steps and outcomes rather than just like you know, left infighting about how it should be done was
right. And
cool
and how quick she was to respond to my question about, you know, should we be retroactive with our legalization of cannabis? You know, that wasn't even a hesitation on her
but part. How would that work? Like, I don't want to get in the weeds because we're debriefing. Yeah. but like, are we talking 1,000 people? Are we talking about 50,000 people? What are we talking about?
I don't know the numbers, but she would basically just strike from the record anyone who is, you know, has a marijuana possession conviction. And so that could mean releasing some people from prison, but it could also just mean cleaning up the record of folks who, you know, are negatively impacted by the fact that they were arrested for marijuana possession. And she just gets it, the fact that addiction is a disease. And so, you know, as you said, C-Money, these coping behaviors, you know, all these, that list of the 15 misdemeanors that she has decided, you know, the first approach will be diversion, is really comprehensive and shows that she did what she said she did, which was talk to all of the people involved, all the people who would be impacted by that decision, and came to a pretty bold stance of like, let's just go ahead and state it. Let's codify it. The fact that we are not going to prosecute first. And I think the impact of that has been shown by that NBER study. But, you know, I think that's the direction that health providers are headed in with addiction. Many of them are already there. But to see law enforcement following in those footsteps is very powerful.
And you know what's left unsaid? She didn't say this, but, you know, earlier we were talking about the folly and the like arrogance of the law enforcement system. By Rachel Rollins stepping out, remember, the Boston police are under her purview. Like, not directly, of course, but by her saying that, they're essentially saying, like, don't bust people for petty drug crime. Right. Don't bust people on methadone mile. I think that's important. She didn't come right out and say that. But if they know and they see that petty shit is being dismissed, they're going to stop making callers for that. Right.
Right. Absolutely. And she pointed out the fact that Dante Wright was pulled over. I mean, I think it was stated actually that it was expired tags, but the air fresheners hanging from the rearview mirror were also a factor, they said.
That's racist AF.
Like, exactly. She said that. And, you know, she didn't say it that way.
Well,
but,
no, that's a quote.
But like you say,
I'm just kidding.
Like you say,
sorry, Rachel.
Like you say, Dan, the idea of making it clear to police that you're not going to follow up with prosecution from those types of arrests
right.
is going to change their behavior on the streets.